And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Over the last couple of days, I have been devouring and absolutely amazing and harrowing and ultimately inspiring memoir by Adele Berthe. I'm sure many of you know that name well. Such a gifted singer and songwriter, also a really gifted writer and director, the author of two previous books, Peter and the Wolves and Why La Belle Matters, and now the author of a memoir of her early childhood called Twist and American Girl. This is, if I understand correctly, conceived as part of a trilogy, and Peter and the Wolves is part of that trilogy of memoirs. But this, from an earlier portion in her life, that charts what can only be described as an excruciatingly difficult, sometimes brutally difficult childhood. And she emerges from the other side of that intact and ready to take on the world. And it's really an amazing story and really, really beautifully written. And so we're going to be talking with Adele Berthe for the next few minutes about her early life and about the experience of writing this amazing book again titled Twist, An American Girl. Adele Berthe, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm really happy to be here with you.
I'm glad we can have this this conversation. One of the choices that you make, I would love to hear a little more about this, is that although this is a memoir, this is the story of your own life, you give voice to your story through a narrator you name Maddie Twist. And it's almost like kind of an alter ego, someone who is, in a sense, almost speaking on your behalf. Explain to our listeners what led you to want to frame the book in this way.
This has been a really difficult book to write, as you can imagine, having read it. But I've been picking it up and putting it away in a drawer for years at a time, and finally decided that the way to go to find the voice for this book was to create a character name, which gave me the strength and the armor to move through those stories of my childhood with some protection and with a little bit more clarity. It is true that my grandmother on my Italian side of the family, on my father's side, they, for three generations, the women were named Maria Maddalena, which is Mary Magdalene. And I thought Madeline would be a great name, and Twist because Oliver Twist. And my mother, her name was Kitty, and they referred to her as Kitty Twist from Jane Fonda's character in Walk on the Wild Side.
It's really incredible, and I think at one point you call this this character Maddie Twist a Trojan horse. It's almost like a way in which you can kind of sneak through to tell this story in really unguarded fashion. We should say that it mostly takes place in Cleveland, Ohio, where you were born and raised. I say raised in quotation marks, actually, because of course it's really a harrowing childhood that we will explore. The years are 1965 through 1972, and of course the world has changed in all kinds of drastic ways from then until now. And I think you say at one point early on, the book tells how it felt to be me in 1965 through 1972, white, working class, poor, queer, abandoned, and hungry for belonging. Before we talk about your story, I wonder how much you think about how this story is so rooted in that period. That is, if through some magic wand this had taken place 2005 to 2012, I mean, in a completely different era, how differently all of this would play out. How much does this story, in a sense, intractably belong to the time in which it occurred?
Well, for one thing, it's what's really interesting to me about the time frame is that how certain things haven't changed. Yes, things have gotten much better in terms of civil rights and gender, but at the same time, we seem to be taking some steps backwards. But one of the reasons I wanted to root it in that time period politically also was so that I couldn't be accused of basically whitewashing the book. I had to tell the truth of what it felt like to be me back in that time when civil rights was, you know, there were people in the streets constantly and all our leaders were being assassinated. And it was a very, very heavy time. And it was a heavy time in terms of race and gender. And I think, you know, we're in a period right now where people want to ban books and they want to pretend that people didn't talk certain ways or use, you know, certain language to describe things. It's a very strange time. And I didn't want to have to whitewash the history of it. In terms of race, I was a white girl growing up for a couple of years in a black milieu, a reformatory for girls that was probably about 90% black, which was, so I was the anomaly, and I learned so much about black culture, and it really held me. It buoyed my life for a while. What I'm trying to say is, I think I say it in the author's note, I was not willing to whitewash how people spoke, what people felt in those days.
Right. Well, I'm certainly glad that this book is written in such unvarnished fashion. I can scarcely imagine the story being told any other way. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Adele Berthe about her newest book, which is a memoir called Twist, An American Girl. At the heart of this very, very difficult childhood is your mother, Kitty, who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. You pose such an interesting question at one point. You say, my mother suffered from paranoid schizophrenia and was physically abused by my father. And who really knows what came first? That's such an interesting possibility. And I wonder how much you continue to reflect on that or have any insights on what we are talking about. Did the abuse that your mother suffered at the hand of her husband, your father, was that any kind of a cause of what happened, or was the fact that she was sick in this way and her husband misunderstood that, could that have contributed to the abuse? I mean, it's a terrible question to pose, but it's also a fascinating one.
Yes. Growing up in the 50s and 60s, the roles of working class women were extremely defined to motherhood and being the perfect housewife. All of the TV shows, the commercials, everything was geared towards women being the perfect wife, looking a certain way, keeping the house a certain way, being subservient to men. And my mother, who grew up in very dire circumstances with her own mother, my grandmother played honky-tonk piano in bars during the Depression, which was a very dangerous thing to do, and she was a single mother. So my mother grew up with trauma, and she couldn't fit into that mold of what a woman should be. She was too imaginative, and you know, being a woman at that time and not having any validation for your thoughts or your creative life was extremely hard, and a lot of women were. At that time were taking, you know, pills, like Valley of the Dolls was one of the most popular novels of the time. And I think that between those gendered restrictions she was feeling and the fact that she had an abusive husband and she started drinking and taking medications that were prescribed by a psychiatrist, it just kind of escalated to the point where she started to have psychotic breaks. But here's the interesting thing, is that although she could be abusive, her imagination and her creativity was so brilliant and wild and wonderful that I took it as my badge of courage to really go forward in my life in brave ways, to have courage to keep pushing on. So I was able to kind of turn her supposed affliction, which was her creative escape in a way, into a way of living that I don't think I would ever have accomplished anything I've accomplished in life if it hadn't have been for her wild imagination and the courage she inspired in me.
Hmm. Some of the most difficult things to read in the book are about the abuse that she suffered at the hands of her husband, your dad, Al. There's one scene in particular that leapt out at me, since I'm an opera fan, and there's a story you tell of him really mercilessly beating your mother while the voice of Maria Callas is playing. She's on television at the time, and this scene is playing out with this voice filling the room. But of course, the story is also of some of the abuse that you suffered at her hands, and also an incredible scene in which at one point you come home to discover that your mom is abusing herself in a really frightening way. I'm going to leave it to our listeners to read those details for themselves, but it leads you to run around the kitchen grabbing every knife you can find or anything else in which your mother could potentially harm herself. I mean, that's just a scene I can't get out of my mind. I wonder, what do you feel was kind of the lasting impact on you of living in a home where there was this abuse going on in so many directions, but particularly this abuse that your mother was directing upon herself?
Well, something that I realized as a kid, and you know, would have to parse out to be able to abide by what had happened to me. I was kind of a stoic as a kid, you know. I knew I had to push on. And in the midst of the tragedies and the violence in my home, I was forced to think deeply about human nature. And I read a lot as a kid. I read Dickens and I read all of the romantic poets. And I had to really ponder human nature and why people commit such horrible atrocities, and recognize that there's good and bad in everyone, and that I had to keep pushing forward because I knew there would be light at the end of that tunnel, so to speak, and to maximize the positive emotions. And also, you know, people have spoken about magical thinking. I think it gets a bad rap. Magical thinking for me was a way out of those tragedies. I would cling to things like music and books and the worlds that I discovered and the emotions I discovered in art were my life raft.
Mm.
And yes, go ahead.
You touch on that in a couple of really intriguing and beautiful ways. One of the things you describe for us is your first day in maybe sixth grade, and you say you are holding a book of poetry. And you say the book makes the kids gossip about what a weirdo I am, reading poetry and all, but it protects me like a shield against the nitwits. That's such an intriguing idea of holding dear to something like that was, you know, in a sense a cause for, you know, others to deride you and, you know, to kind of marginalize you, but in a sense it also was something that made you feel safe within yourself.
Yes, yes. You know, I think about that, and there are so many young kids of my time period, but I'm sure this happens now too, where you feel like an outcast and you don't belong, you don't fit in with the kids that you're growing up with, and you feel very singular. It's kind of like kids, you know, embracing rock and roll. But yeah, I grew up in a very working class suburb of Cleveland, and I was different. What was going on in my house, and the fact that I loved poetry, and I couldn't bear the banal, so to speak. And yes, it did protect me in my head. It didn't protect me in school when I would get beaten up or when I was discovered as being queer. But it was kind of an inner world that I could go to.
Hmm. Something else you describe from this period is some of the comfort and inspiration that you derived from certain aspects of the Catholic faith, and in particular, if I want to call it, the visuals of the Catholic faith. You write at one point in this unmistakable voice of your young self, "The Catholics are nuts, but I love the paintings, the statues, and sculptures. The art is fantastically bloody and beautiful, and I like the safety of prayerful places." You obviously end up having a very complicated relationship with the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith, but I really find this particularly intriguing, the idea that someone from your kind of circumstances experiencing such a difficult life of the comfort and inspiration that you could find in some of these artistic elements. They obviously spoke to you in a really interesting way.
Yes, I used to imagine my father's ancestors in Italy as being the builders of these magnificent churches. It was my way of creating a better image of my father than what was in reality. But being inside these churches really inspired me and gave me that, it kind of paid off that promise of sanctuary for me. Churches felt like sanctuary because of the air. The actual air is imbued with so much peace and grace and longing for comfort and receiving that comfort. And so much of Catholic art is, you see people's faces in, the faces of saints or of Jesus, and they look like this combination of being in suffering but also being in ecstasy. And it embodied like the idea that pain can be transmuted alchemically into a type of grace. And I held on to that. I still absolutely love churches. Whenever I go to Europe, the first thing I do is like hit new ancient churches that I've never visited before. But yes, I do have a complicated history with Catholicism, for sure.
We're speaking with Adele Berthe, author of Twist, An American Girl. This is a memoir of her childhood growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, 1965 to 1972. At some point, your mother's own mental illness becomes so severe that social services is called, and you and your siblings are removed from the home, removed from her care, and some of the book chronicles your experience in a couple of different foster situations. Tell our listeners about a certain blue notebook that was such a very, very important part of your life during at least some of these years.
I wrote poetry when I was a kid, and like when I was going through some of these experiences with my natal family, and it's the one thing I was able to bring with me, maybe a few belongings, and that was the one precious thing. And I don't want to give away the story, but let's just say that it was destroyed in by a foster sibling, which led to me running away and having a very intense tragedy happen. But I just wanted to say something briefly about foster care. The foster care system in America is so overburdened. And I was in two foster homes, one of which was abusive, and the other, which was incredibly kind. And I just don't want to give away the story, but again, it so much of this, I don't want people to think that it's a misery memoir, you know, because it's not about wearing my trauma as some kind of badge, but it's more about how I was able to keep moving forward and transcending and transmuting these tragedies into lessons about life that I could use toward going forward.
Absolutely. I certainly think it's important for us to make sure the listeners understand that. And I think that's one of the reasons why I use the word inspiring to talk about this memoir, because that is part of what I took away from it. In fact, when you are writing at one point about this blue notebook in which you poured so many of your inner thoughts, you describe it this way: I have a blue notebook. I write in careful, delicate script, feeling every word as it moves from my head to the pen. Writing is like singing, and a private thing for me alone. You know, it makes you especially sad for somebody who grows up in maybe comparable circumstances and either does not understand or does not maybe have the same gifts in which, you know, they can turn to something as simple as an empty notebook and a pen and experience what you experienced with your blue notebook.
An empty notebook and a pen, or paintbrushes, or, you know, a camera, or any of the arts. What's so interesting to me about our society today in America and how broken it is that I'm going off on a little tangent, but is the fact that instead of some parents, and not all, I'm talking about specific people, would prefer to give their child a gun than give them a source of creative expression. The arts in this country has really been suppressed. It's taken out of the schools. It's very hard for artists to make money, and I'm talking about musicians, etc. But imagine our society if we were fostered towards creativity as opposed to hatred and violence in the name of Christianity. It just blows my head off that, you know, that's where we are today. But art was very important to me as a kid, all of the arts.
Right. I wanted to mention an interesting turn of phrase when you talk about the second of the two foster families that took you in. And these were the parents of a schoolmate of yours. And of course, the first foster situation really was indeed terrible. I mean, I think at some point you might even liken it to kind of a Cinderella sort of story in terms of the way that you were treated, the fold-out cot that you slept on next to the beautiful canopy bed of the daughter of the family and so on. But this second foster situation is very, very different. And as you first entered that home and saw what it was like and the way that they were treating you, said, it all seems so normal, almost painfully kind. And I think this is sometimes what we hear about people who have experienced a lot of pain and deprivation in their life, that kindness and compassion can be such a strange and unexpected thing that it can almost be difficult to take in and accept. And I suspect you had that experience more than once through the course of your young life.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, when you grow up in a home that is absolutely abnormal to you know, the people around you and the families and houses around you, you don't understand what normal is. And suddenly, kindness, which is, of course, beautifully accepted, it's like, what is this? You know, as a child, you're trying to figure out how to act within that environment. And I was so grateful for that second foster home. The problem was that I was a young teen, and I was experiencing my sexuality for the first time as a queer kid, and that discovery led my foster sister to, and the school, the junior high school, to turn against me. So I had to leave that family, which was really unfortunate.
You ultimately, in a sense, hit the road as a hitchhiker. And what you are thinking is that you're going to join up with some of those peace and love hippies that you had heard about and probably seen on TV. You described the situation of kind of standing at the roadside, hitchhiking, say, I hold out my thumb and hope I'm not pointed in the wrong direction. You ultimately kind of were headed in the wrong direction a couple different ways, but we'll leave that to our listeners to explore. You eventually end up at the Marycrest School for Wayward Girls with a mother superior who had, in your words, the face of a hammerhead shark. But I really appreciate the way in which I think you very fairly recount your experiences there. And I think there are some people who might take such a chapter from their life and either kind of make fun of it or focus entirely on the negative of it. And I'm very, very impressed with the fairness and even-handedness with which you describe the Marycrest Home for Wayward Girls and the nuns there with whom you interacted. I wonder how much you kind of thought about that as you tell, for instance, this chapter of your life and what led you to ultimately tell the story the way that you do.
The Marycrest School for Girls was run by an order called the Sisters of the Good Shepherd, and they were one of three or four orders in Ireland that ran the Magdalene Laundries. I don't know if you've heard about the Magdalene Laundries, but in Ireland, young women who had children out of wedlock or were thought of as, I love that word, wayward, yeah, were put into these Magdalene Laundries. And mine wasn't as draconian as the Irish Magdalene Laundries. We didn't have to work in a laundry. But there were so many moments of grace and sanctuary and safety when I was living in that school. And I'll never forget the kindness of some of the nuns. And it is true that there is kindness and there is benevolence in some Catholic institutions. And we're used to hearing all these horrid stories. But again, there's evil and good in everyone. And if we can understand that, instead of just going with the flow of what people say about one institution or one type of people or any of that, for me it was really important. It was so important. Identity is always in flux, and when I was going through these different situations, I had to be whoever I could be in order to survive that particular situation. So when I was at Marycrest, I did feel an incredible feeling of grace for a while in that school.
And then unfortunately, an encounter you had with another woman there, a young woman, and your queerness, in a sense, exposed, led to kind of a disintegration of what had been such a, in many ways at least, a positive experience. Ultimately, you end up at the Blossom Hill School for Girls. And this is a very, very different setting. One of the things that leapt out at me as you described your time there was what it was like to go to the Baptist church services. You were given, I think, a choice of attending Baptist services or Catholic services, or I suppose no service at all, but you opted for the Baptist service. And you write, if there really is a God, well, then God has to be music. And you go on to say, of all the music I've listened to, there's nothing so grand as the sound of voices singing gospel music. And it's not about perfect notes. It's more like a messy, glorious swell of mischievous angels hollering their ecstasy, sure to raise every hair on the back of your neck with the magic of the Spirit. I think one of the things I love about your book is that in a story that is filled with so much pain, that the moments that are glorious and wonderful and uplifting are not lost at all in that swirl of pain. In fact, in some ways, they shine even more brightly because of just the sense of contrast with so much of the difficulty of your life. I imagine right. You look back on moments like this with tremendous gratitude.
I do. I experienced the joy of singing in Blossom Hill in a way I never had before because, you know, singing was something I would do under the covers. You know, I'm very private about singing as a child. But at Blossom Hill, singing with other girls and the joy and the warmth of gospel music was a revelation to me. And it really it opened me up to feel like I wanted to use my voice as an instrument in future, you know, from there. But yeah, it was a miraculous feeling, I have to say. And I did think if there is a God, and I had been through many experiences that where one would think, if this couldn't be godlike, what's happening? That the music was the liberation of all of it, was the path towards a certain kind of, again, I love this word grace, and grace, I love the concept of grace, and I believe that that music is a way to transcend suffering and pain.
Hmm. Well, that's certainly a very, very big part of your story. Ultimately, also part of your story is of coming to terms with who you are, and in particular, with your own queerness, and with being a woman. And repeatedly in the book, you would express these feelings of, in a sense, having been cursed to be born a woman. I mean, just trying to being mistreated, seeing other women being mistreated in all kinds of different ways. I wonder what ultimately was the key to you, in a sense, moving through that or rising above those kinds of feelings about being a woman and feeling like, in a sense, it was a curse to be a woman.
I saw so much pain on my maternal side with my grandmother and my mother and what they suffered for being, having been born women, and it made me want to be a boy because boys had freedom, boys were not treated like chattel, boys had adventures, and the world was their oyster, you know, whereas what I saw in my life as a child was that women were just not given any of the same opportunities, and so I became very androgynous growing up and very embracing of my boyish side. And that would continue for a lot of my life. I didn't feel like I was trapped necessarily in a female body, as many trans people do. But I it was more of the fact that I wanted those adventures. I wanted that freedom. I wanted that equality. And I felt like I wasn't going to be able to get it as a girl.
Hmm. A last question. What has the experience been like, ultimately, to write this memoir? You talked about how it was something you had to put away repeatedly, sometimes, if I understood correctly, for maybe years at a time. Now having completed it, what has the experience been like to, I assume, relive a lot of what you experienced during these mostly very difficult years?
I realized that what kept me afloat through these years was always looking for the good in people and music. And realizing that you don't have power over the events in your life, but we do have power over our mind and our choices, and to maximize positive emotion and understand why people become who they are, like to look at the systemic ways people become cruel or, you know, abusive, and to understand that there's we have no control over that. The only thing we have control over is basically our choices, and those the way we're going, the way we relate to those events. So I would hope that, that anyone who reads the book that has been through any traumas in their life would maybe find some solace or some courage about what they may be going through. I don't know. I would hope that that would be a good message to come away with.
I couldn't agree more. I found the book very, very powerful and, again, uplifting in all kinds of ways, including some very surprising ways. The book, again, is Twist, An American Girl, a memoir, a part of a trilogy, ultimately, of memoirs by Adele Berthe. The book is published by ZE Books. Adele Berthe, thank you so much, first of all, for telling your story in such remarkably vivid fashion. And thank you for being my guest on The Morning Show. I was really grateful for this opportunity to speak with you. Best wishes.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Greg. I appreciate it deeply.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Now to an interesting morning show interview that was recorded and initially broadcast 20 years ago, way back in 2003. Well, I am not exactly on familiar turf for this portion of the morning show, but nonetheless, I'm really excited about the chance to speak with Anthony Boza, who has been a writer and editor for Rolling Stone magazine and has recently written a book called Whatever You Say I Am, The Life and Times of Eminem. And Eminem is, of course, one of the most important and most controversial figures in popular music today, a rap artist who has racked up all kinds of important awards and just really made a statement in his music and in the way he has conducted himself in a way that's really been quite extraordinary. And Anthony Boza followed Eminem and has really written an interesting account of who he is and what he is all about. And we have Anthony Boza with us for a few minutes to talk about this book, again, entitled Whatever You Say I Am. Anthony Boza, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
First of all, if I may ask you just a quick general question about what you do as someone who's written, for instance, for Rolling Stone magazine and following somebody like Eminem, what is the life like for a journalist within the realm of popular music?
Have you seen Almost Famous? it could be pretty much like that. You know, I was at Rolling Stone from 95 to 2002 as a staff writer, so it involves a lot of traveling when you're really sort of you know, there's a period where I was doing a lot of cover stories and a lot of bigger pieces. It involves a lot of traveling, a lot of turning stories around very quickly, especially with Rolling Stone because the magazine comes out every 2 weeks. So you have to, if you get a story, it's usually very last minute, and you have to get out there, do interviews on the road. You know, I've lived on tour buses for a week at a time with bands, hotel rooms, and you got to kind of turn it around really quickly and make sense of it. You know, it's an interesting path to navigate because a lot of times it's kind of, I always say that it's like going on a first date, like every single day, or, you know, you've got only a certain amount of time with an artist, especially now that there are so many magazines like Rolling Stone. You're usually competing for the amount of time that you get. Artists are continually giving the same answers because, I mean, you can't blame them. There's only so many questions that you can really kind of think of to get to the bottom of their music. And you're in that sort of environment constantly thinking of a way to make your story different without just, well, and I mean, I never like to kind of just go sensationalistic unless there's a real reason to. So it's just very fast-paced. It'll make you tired pretty quick, so you better rest up.
How long did you end up following Eminem through the course of writing this book?
Well, this book is I've been writing about him since 1999. I was the first person to do a national cover story on him anywhere. I was the only person that he agreed to let interview his mother and encourage his mother to talk to me. And, you know, that story was really kind of a real moment. For this book, it was things that I didn't get into my Rolling Stone stories and, you know, interviews I'd already used. When I approached him about doing the book, he had just done 8 Mile, had just done The Eminem Show, which is his most personal record to date, really. And he didn't really want to do a whole big book and be completely overexposed. That said, he gave me his blessing to go ahead and write whatever I wanted. So the book is like a sort of composite of all the time I've spent with him over 4 years, and a lot of the topics that sort of resonated with me, particularly watching how he went from the most hated person in pop music to America's newest darling in just the span of about 9 months.
So some of this, some of what we find in the pages of this book actually predates when you were actually sitting down to write this book, while some of it is more recent encounters.
Yeah, a lot of it, you know, when I did my first story, Rolling Stone's only out on the stands for 2 weeks, and it kind of came and went, and at that time a lot of people who would be looking to understand Eminem now really didn't care or had no idea who he was. So a lot of the stuff is going to be, you know, seen as fresh and new for the first time by a lot of the readers of the book.
One of the things you talk about in terms of Eminem's childhood, he grew up in Detroit, correct?
Yes.
You say you spent some time in Detroit with Eminem, and he showed you the places that had formed and malformed him. I don't know if those are his words or yours. They look like your words. What do you mean by them?
Well, he grew up, you know, he had a very tough upbringing. He grew up poor in inner city Detroit. He lived for, you know, long periods of time in trailer parks just outside of the inner city as well. He was the only white guy, you know, well, one of the few white people on his block. And being a white kid who was into rap music, he was totally ostracized. He was a skinny kid with a big mouth. He was beaten up by bullies all the time. He basically went through a lot of hard times. He didn't have a father. His father left when he was 6 months old. He's had a very tumultuous relationship with his mother. And, she ended up suing him for $10 million after he was a success. So I think that alone should give people an indication of what their relationship has always been like. So, that's pretty much what I was getting at. Those hardships and those troubles formed him in the sense that when he started writing music, he took all those experiences and turned them into art, sort of made a reality show of his life, sort of took those advantages and made them advantages. At the same time, they also, you know, he's got a lot of issues. You know, he's still kind of, did a lot of damage. And that's what I meant by malformed him.
You also liken this media frenzy that has surrounded him for several years now. You liken it to a storm. At one point, you say that by following his career, as you have since 1999, and having spent so much time with him personally in many, many different interviews, you say, "I've seen the effect that storm has had on him." In a nutshell, what has that storm done to Eminem?
There's a period of time right after his, you know, he pretty much skyrocketed right to the top and has never really left that space since 1999. At first it was, he was just so excited to be there, and he felt like, you know, the party could stop at any given moment, that it just, it made him a bit crazy, he was living for the moment, maybe a little too much, and it kind of, he just kind of went a little wild. What he then did, and this is a testament to his character, is that he really sort of turned himself around and became really professional and diversified his career and basically took everything a lot more seriously. That also made him a lot less open. He's just sort of become, you know, more paranoid, as people have, you know, the more successful you are, the more people will want things from you and the more there is for them to take from you. So that's kind of what I was getting at. I was, you know, watching how the attention affected him and how he, what he did in response to it.
This is a rather unsparing portrait of Eminem, I should think. Although I'm intrigued by what seems to be your kind of your mixed feelings about Eminem, at least in some sense. I mean, you don't go out of your way to try to reveal some sort of soft, cuddly side to Eminem. We really see him in the pages of this book, warts and all.
Yeah, and I don't think he'd have it any other way. But that was part of the reason why I was glad, to be honest, that he felt like it wasn't really time for him to do his official autobiography. You know, I'm equally as glad, clearly, that he trusted me to write what I wanted to write. Because there's as much as I am a fan, there are things in the music and topics that he talks about, like, you know, a lot of the misogyny and other stuff that are disturbing. And certainly I can see the point that a lot of his detractors make. And I tried to get them in there as much as possible as well. Even though I might not agree with everything they have to say, I can't really just dismiss all of it either. So I just really wanted to be as sort of simultaneously objective and subjective as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that might seem like they're kind of mutually exclusive, and it definitely posed a challenge at times, but that's pretty much what I was trying to get at, and hopefully came across.
I think very much so. That's a tricky balancing act. We hear so much about leading pop artists being amazingly self-absorbed. How would you rate Eminem on the self-absorption scale?
Well, I think you've got a guy here that, you know, has based all of his music on his most personal, sort of the inner workings of his mind. I would rate him pretty high on the self-absorption thing because, like, that's where his inspiration comes from. He sort of goes up into his mind and is taking his most personal moments and committing them to song. You know, he takes all of the anger, all the frustration, all the tough times he's had. He basically gets to the bottom of those feelings, and at their most raw is when he decides to sit down and write lyrics.
One of the things I think is helpful for some of us who don't know a whole lot about Eminem and, you know, don't know hardly anything at all about rap, for instance, if this is not our music or our thing, it's just interesting to study a phenomenon like Eminem and to understand how he got to where he is. One of the things, for instance, you say about Eminem at one point is that he has an exceptional sense of timing and an exceptional sense of image management.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and to the casual observer, I don't think that would occur to us at all, that those would be among his most important skills.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, you can't underestimate oversaturation. And he knows kind of when to come out and promote and show himself and when to go away. And when you go away is when people miss you. If you go away too long, however, they might forget about you. He also knows how to take every kind of bit of opposition that he's met with and turn it into whatever his next project is going to be. You know, he had a reputation for doing too many drugs, but he went up on stage at the MTV Awards and in 2000 and went up there and basically acted like he was dropping a bunch of pills out of his pocket, you know, and that takes guts, and it's also hilarious, you know. One of his main ways of doing all that stuff and continually making those statements is through comedy. Like, you can't underestimate how important it is to his controversial status that he just seems to make a big joke out of all of it all the time.
The Life and Times of Marshall Bruce Mathers III, also known as Eminem. The book is called Whatever You Say I Am by Anthony Boza. It's published by Crown Publishers. Anthony Boza, I enjoyed reading the book and enjoyed speaking with you today on The Morning Show. We thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.